Today's meeting of the Governance Committee. First item for consideration is approval of the agenda, and I would like to make one change. The discussion of the revisions to the Board Code of Ethics is going to be an information item and not an action item for today. So with that amendment, is there a motion to approve the agenda as submitted?
Move approval, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, it's been moved and seconded by Mr. Downey that we approve the agenda. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Anybody abstain? All right. Next, we have the minutes from the March 13th meeting. If you've had a chance to read over those, I'll entertain a motion. Motion? Did I hear you make a notice, Artis? Okay. All right. Mort moves. Artis seconds. All those in favor signify by saying aye. All right.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain. Okay, first item is the discussion of the revisions to the Board Code of Conduct. Madam General Counsel, you want to walk us through those?
Yes, I do. Thank you very much.
Let me preface it by saying we did have earlier discussion on these, so this is not on some of the changes, especially as it relates to what MWA has done, and if you could kind of put it in that context just to remind folks this
right.
is based on what MWA has done.
Okay, thank you. And I have with me Phil Staub, who is the Chief Counsel of Governance and Human Resources in my department, and he's been doing a lot of the line work on keeping track of this and drafting the major revision, the pieces of it that are constitute revisions and additions and clarifications. So he will assist me in walking through this, but I do want to take a minute and just provide the framework and context and remind everybody where we've been and how we got here. First of all, as part of the annual review and update of governance documents, I was asked to look at a number of the governance documents, including the bylaws and the code of ethics was part of that package. It became apparent shortly after I became the first ethics officer of WMATA that we lacked generally in our governance documents the detailed procedure of how the ethics officer was to operate when questions arose and issues needed to be reviewed and discussed with the ethics committee or board members about ethics issues. So one of the main drivers of and some of the key changes to this document were made to actually detail the ethics officer duties and the process around the giving opinions and how that would work through the ethics committee and so on and so forth when there is a question or need for an opinion of the ethics officer. But other than that, in large part, this came about as a part of the normal annual review. It became important, I think, to also keep in mind that in December of 2012, MWA, which is a similarly situated agency to WMATA, it is a compact agency comprised of the District of Columbia and Virginia, and it's also subject to oversight by the Federal Department of Transportation, IG. And MWA had in the December of 2012 adopted a new code of ethics that was blessed, if you will, by the DOTIG. And we thought that that was a very important document for us to spend a lot of time looking at and learning from and seeing what we could incorporate from that with the view that because it was the same regulatory body, it would be instructive for us to learn from that and model our code on the MWA code. So we are using in the Code of Ethics version before you, we're using as the base document the MWA Code of Ethics, and we made changes to that base document to have it fit more appropriately with the circumstances we have here at WMATA. There were three, I would say, major buckets, maybe four major buckets of categories of changes that we addressed. One is we made changes to the base document to reflect the fact that our board, unlike the MWA board, has elected officials on the board. And so it was very, very important that we have provisions that reflected the elected officials that provide service to WMATA, and that we account for and allow for opportunity for those elected officials to serve their other public interests in an appropriate manner in a way that doesn't conflict with their duties to WMATA. Secondly, the WMATA board is no longer engaged in major procurement activities, the review and approval of major procurement activities, and that is a significant difference from the MWA board. The MWA board does still hold responsibility for approving procurements. And so it's also the case that in the old version, the prior version of WMATA's Code of Ethics, the board had been very heavily involved in procurement. So we had a lot of language in the old code that was tied to that procurement function. And Phil will spend some time talking about that. But our rules tended to revolve around financial interest and details of financial interest in companies that would be coming before the board. And that's really no longer the major driver of the ethical issues that face the WMATA board today because of the change in policy about procurement no longer being a board function predominantly. The third major change, as I mentioned, was the focus on the ethics officer and the provisions around getting opinions from the ethics officer and how that whole process works back through the committee. And then the fourth major change was to really clarify the fiduciary duties that are owed to WMATA and the duty of care that is owed back to the jurisdictional partners. And so in large, you know, broad strokes, that's what we've done, but I'm going to ask now Phil to walk through that in whatever detail you'd like.
Okay. Bill?
Thank you. So the format here, just to explain the different colors that you're looking at, you have some highlights within the body of the document. Those indicate where we're straying from the sources that we've identified on the right-hand side comments. And I'll get into those a little more specifically as I go through them.
Before you go on, let me just check with the members. At our last meeting, we did kind of go through some of these proposed changes, and we talked about the MWA document. So I will see whether or not committee members, you want to indicate how detailed you want to go through, since we've gone through most of these, at least as they relate to similar parts to what's in MWA, and I guess the big difference is more on the fiduciary responsibility point. So people want to go through each item, or are there questions that you have, or can we do the 30,000 foot, you just point out some of the key highlights? All right, hearing that response, why don't you give us the 30,000 foot approach and just hit some of the highlights, and then we'll finish with fiduciary piece.
Okay, so to take the 30,000 foot view, I would actually then ask the committee to make sure I'm using your page numbers, to turn to page 11 in your materials for the first significant change in the document. This is the definition of substantial interest or duty. Catherine was just talking earlier about the change in focus from the procurement function. The prior code of ethics was mainly interested in financial interests, and we're now at this version adopts the MWA approach, where there's a bit less focus on interests that occur through income or ownership interest, and greater focus as you turn the page, as this definition, substantial interest or duty, continues on page 12 of your materials.
Yes,
okay, right. So I thought it would be easier to refer to the packet page numbers, but I can refer to the page numbers of the Code of Ethics alone if that's easier.
What do you prefer?
Okay, well, so Right now, we're in.
Where he started is on page 10, I guess, of the iPad, when he talked about substantial interest duty.
Here, why don't you go to substantial?
Yeah.
It's page 3 of the.
Yeah.
The article's good. That's a good way to put it.
The article, so we're in Article 3, K. Article 3 is definitions. Item K is substantial interest or duty. It's page 3 of the standalone document, but you may have a different page number in front of you.
It's page 10 on the iPad.
Okay, so I'll stop referring to the packet numbers because that's just confusing. So, I see. Okay. So the definition, it goes in your materials from page 10 to 11. But again, it's Article 3, Part K, substantial interest or duty. And the point here is really that it includes other interests and duties that were not formally captured by the direct and indirect financial interests that are in the current Board Code of Ethics. And it includes things like personal representation and fiduciary duties owed to perhaps another board of directors that one of our directors simultaneously sits on. That definition gets used later under conflicts of interest. So it's important to recognize that that now includes other elements. I would then turn to Article 4, conflicts of interest, because that too is has some substantial differences in following the AMWA model from the current Board Code of Ethics. Previously, again, the focus was on direct and indirect financial interests. Now, an actual conflict rests on this definition of a substantial interest or duty that we just talked about in an interested party or other party that may realize some sort of benefit or detriment as a result of board action. So that's an actual conflict of interest, and this code of ethics is, I think, clear that the only resolution of an actual conflict of interest is recusal from a matter. Whereas this code in the very next section, Article 4B, let me just follow along here.
That's page 12 of the
page 12 in your materials. Now, uses a definition of apparent conflict of interest, which is not an easy concept to define, and was not defined at all in our prior code. So this provides a definition, and this code then provides other means to cure an apparent conflict. So apparent conflict can be resolved through recusal, but there's also divestiture is a possible way of curing an apparent conflict, as is a declaration. And there are even cases of compact-required participation, which are all covered in the next article. I'll pause there if there are any questions on how
any
that
questions?
Works.
Okay, keep rolling.
Okay, keep rolling. So I will then just sort of pass over the next Article 5, which speaks to what I was just getting into, the various methods to cure conflicts. And again, the recusal, it would be the only method for actual conflicts. Apparent conflicts can be resolved in other ways. Again, much of this comes from EMWA, but I would actually pause for a second on the idea of divestiture. So that is Article 5B,
that's page 13.
In your materials, page 6 in the code that perhaps others are looking at. This is to address the fact that WMATA members are different than MLA members in that they are, some of them are elected officials and maybe accepting campaign contributions and not realizing their sources, and simply divesting of those would be a way to resolve that. That is not in the MWA code, but we felt it was needed here for our different circumstances.
Okay. Question.
Divestiture or recusal are two options.
Correct.
For apparent conflicts, that's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Choose which one works best.
That's correct. And declaration would be a third in, under certain circumstances.
Right. And in our instances, we're asking the chair of the ethics committee to be involved in the decision of which one is most appropriate. And, of course, the ethics officer is, would be available for a consultation there as well.
Yes, science. Yes, ma'am.
And I'd like to go back to Article 4 just for a minute. I know this didn't do that quickly, but I think when you look at D on the top of page 12, we added this phrase at the end that says, or would you view the cabinet capability in terms of person benefits and action for the MLA language would not say would, but says could. And I'm just wondering why you went to would. I know it seems like a small thing, but it actually is a difference in terms of the standard, you know, could mean any person, would mean someone has to, somebody has to have said, you're going to, maybe it's a small difference, but I just wondered if there's a reason.
There's no particular reason for would, other than it's a reference back to this reasonable person standard that we're using. So it doesn't come right out and say it, but the intent is that this would be or would be viewed by a reasonable person as having the capability to influence, etc.
All right. Would you prefer could?
Well, I think the difficulty with would as an enforcement is, I just think it's harder. You know, I know we have the reasonable person knowledge of the rest, but again, judgment, much judgment involved here about whether or not, I mean, that's the trouble. If they're not mind controller and somebody's really out to get you, they can put any allegation out there that comes to their mind, whether it's based on factors or not. And they create the appearance of conflict of interest because nobody cares whether they understand the facts. They put it out there, they broadcast it, it's over. So that's why I think could is actually a better word because the reality is it's over once somebody's broadcasted it. It's very hard to battle it back to the end of the process. So then you ought to just
Any opposition to changing that to could?
No.
Okay. Next. Good point, Mary.
So the next provision that I would move to would be the limits upon accepting gifts. That's Article 7. B. Which is page 14 of your materials. This is, again, adopting the MLA approach, which is significantly different from the approach that we did have. The MLA approach, as used here, is that gifts cannot be accepted from prohibited sources, which in general are entities with an interest in a matter before the board. Just to read that definition for you briefly, it means an interested party or other party whose interest may be substantially affected by the performance or non-performance of the member's duty. I'll just stop there. But so cannot accept a gift from that type of source unless permitted by the list of exceptions that's included in Appendix 1. So I would encourage this to be read closely with that appendix that appears at the end of the materials. I had to make this interesting. That those begin on page 24 of your materials. It lists all the types of gifts that are acceptable, and again, pretty much follows the MLA model and does involve substantial changes from the current code. The current code permits gifts, individual gifts of $75 or less, with aggregate value of $200 or less in any year. To follow the MWA model, the threshold for individual gifts is $25 or less, and an aggregate value of 50. So that's quite a bit different. The other exceptions are pretty much, there are, however, more exceptions in MWA, and they're reflected on these pages, including personal gifts, speaking and engagements, WMATA sponsored events, gifts to household members, prizes, gifts to WMATA, and gifts approved by the Ethics Committee in a public meeting. The only one of those I think is worth paying, or that should be closer viewed, is the exception for widely attended gatherings. That is something that is in this version different from both the current and from MWA. It does generally follow MWA in terms of trying to explain what a widely attended gathering is by stating what it is not. For instance, if it's by invitation only or focused on a particular business, it is not a widely attended gathering. So those are new definitions to try to clarify that section.
Okay.
If there are no...
question on by invitation. I think there's two ways to interpret that. One is that you personally are getting an invitation.
Turn your mic on.
Yeah. There's a difference between being personally invited to an event and being an event to which a group of people are invited.
Well, the intent is, if you look at the whole definition, it says it needs to be open or part of a regularly scheduled program. So, if
it's a large, something that has a large number of people, presumably is part of a broader, regularly scheduled program.
I think that would be the touchstone for how we would look at that. I
as
think
opposed
that
to if the engraved invitation showed up and said,
correct,
please come to dinner at a fancy restaurant, you would say,
that's
oh,
correct.
Well.
That's correct.
Or pay your way.
That's correct.
Let's just focus on a particular. That's
intended to capture, you know, there may be a, and there often are parts of conferences where a particular business seeks to curry favor with the members by saying, we're going to have our folks give you a symposium on a particular subject, but it's clearly geared toward encouraging you to interest in their products. And that would be focused on a particular business.
The content of the meeting.
Correct.
As
opposed to
sponsor. Correct. Any other questions on that? Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Tom? Based on Mary's comment and Mort's comment, and I understand we have to use a lot of judgment here, but I have no idea what what vendors to WMATA, even what their names are or what they do. I mean, I know, like, we're buying Kawasaki rail cars. That's about as much as I know, but, you know, I don't know what kind of...
Toshiba Air Conditioning.
I wouldn't know that one. So you go to an APTA conference, for example, and they're all there. More help me out here. They're all there. So if you go and if you end up just bumping into them, and then they have a hospitality suite, which they all do, or you can't go, right?
No.
Okay.
Hospitality suite is open to everybody.
Yeah.
It's not invitation only, and you would be welcome to go to the hospitality suite at an APTA conference.
Okay, but all right. So, but then, okay, all right. So, what I'm worried about is I just don't know from A to Z what the vendors list even looks like over here?
Neither do I. I just don't put any of them.
You just avoid it?
Yep.
Okay, that's good, that's...
So just stay home and live under a rock.
Just party in a big room.
That's right. With the lights on, yeah, right.
Oh, well. Yeah. If you go to a conference like that, you can't find something going on, and you really have some issues. Okay.
So the next provision that I would highlight, I want to try to get the correct page number. In your materials is page 15. It's Article 8, Bona Fide Religious, Charitable, and Political Contributions. This is something that we retained from the WMATA code and is not in the MWAR code. It's a sort of a sister provision to what I previously described in terms of divesting. This is on the accepting side. That of course, the normal political activities of board members are supposed to continue. Skimming ahead to stay at the 30,000 foot view, I'll just pause briefly on the next page. Article 9, Use of Official Position, Part A3. The highlighted language, responsibility to further WMATA's interests, I'll just put that in there as a placeholder. That relates back to the fiduciary duty discussion that we'll have once I'm done with this 30,000-foot view, but that's okay. Another relevant provision to that discussion. Page 16 of your materials, yes.
Number three.
Okay, staying on that page and moving down to Part B of Article 9, this is the nepotism provision. In short, this is something that was in the prior code, but the nature of the bans have changed because we're adopting the MWA approach. The MWA approach says that no member or household member shall be employed at the authority at the same time the member is serving on the board. It used to be that only participation in that decision was limited, but this would be an all-out ban on that sort of relationship during the member's tenure. As the same would apply to a firm substantially owned or controlled by a member or a member of the immediate family during that term of service. And substantial ownership is greater than 50%. That's following the MWA model, but that is a substantial change. That's why I wanted to point it out. At the same time, the MWA model does say once you get outside of household members, then it goes back to the same participation ban that we previously had in our code. So once you get out to more extended family, it's just the participation ban, not participating in decisions regarding the employment of those more distant family members.
Yes, ma'am. What would your suggestion be that we have, if they're unless they're previously employed?
Well, I mean, that was the other body that I worked on, if they had been employed for, and I think it was at least a year, so it wasn't a season, you know, it was a line, or they had were vested, or, you know, there was some kind of, this is an organization of teachers, so it was, they had to be, I think, it had to be a continuing contact. But I think the issue is as long as she's a member, it's okay for the publication.
But my suggestion would be, if you think we should have that, I would just as soon get those things out now so that we can get as many of these things done as we can, so when we come back in May, we'll be in a position to act pretty quickly on this. So if you're suggesting that we add something like that?
I think it's for the group to decide. The decision not to include it is something that then has to be communicated to jurisdictions, just like the ownership group does.
Correct.
That annually organize our assets. If we can't appoint somebody who has a household member and employee before.
Was there any reaction by other members to that?
Yeah, I would suggest we leave it as it is. I'm concerned about perceptions here. If a board member has a household member, a spouse, basically, or an adult child working at the authority, I think you have a problem with the board member for being perceived to have extra information that other board members don't have, or, on the other hand, that employee being perceived to have extra influence. And I think either way, whether it's a problem or not, I think you have a perception issue.
Any other thoughts on that?
Certainly, this found its way into the MWOC code because they had more than a perception issue.
Unfortunately, since they had more than a perception issue, we have to worry about the perception.
Yeah. Okay, well, unless people feel strongly, we'll keep it as it is. Next.
Okay.
Following along in this Article 9, use of official position, just quickly point out that the last part, C, postal amount of service restrictions, consistent with MWA, the period for accepting employment with a party to work on a matter in which the board member has participated is extended from 1 year to two.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
I appreciate the feedback that you got when I asked. Is work on a matter before
the MWOC? Yes, that's working on the same matter in which the board member. Yes. Right. If you participate in a matter at WMATA, for the subsequent 2 years, there would be a ban against working with a private party on that matter. It's not working with a party altogether, it's just on that matter.
So maybe there's
a way to provide a slight bit more clarity here, that it is on the same. Well, it says it. I'm sorry. Yeah, I think it's, yeah. Yeah, well, the last one where it says in which the board member has participated, I think is what I think.
To work on a matter, not to work for a party, but to work on a matter is what it says. But is it also true participate means it has to be something that actually came before the board? It isn't something that was happening down the hall that we didn't know about.
That's correct.
Right. Yeah. The participate is a defined term meaning
right.
Discuss,
actual
votes, et
cetera. Votes, yes. Right, knowledge.
Can I ask a question on that? What if a board member gets part of a vote, gets heavily involved in a particular issue?
I think real estate issues.
Yes, real estate would definitely be a case where you'd have a problem.
Even if they don't eventually vote on it, but if they participate.
Another reason to revise.
We've never had that happen here.
No, not at all.
Right, participate, just to address that, participate includes voting, addressing, discussing, or otherwise attempting to influence a decision of the board of directors or any action undertaken by WMATA.
Okay.
So if someone were improperly attempting to influence a WMATA action, they would be in violation if they then went to work for that.
Correct. Party,
even if the board didn't technically act on it. If they said, hire these guys, and then next week went to work for them, we've got an issue.
Correct.
Moving to the next article, 10 on page 17, not to go article by article. I don't want to get into this all that specifically, but this is where we gathered all the requirements to make disclosures and acknowledgments. It's a little bit different from the MWA code in format only because we're gathering all of them here rather than having them dispersed throughout the code. And just note that this will involve changes to the forms that we're currently using, which again, because they focus on the current definitions of direct and indirect financial interests and relate to percent of gross income and percent of annual income, these tests are quite a bit more straightforward. And the forms will be changing in concert with that.
Yeah, I was just saying, April 30th is coming up very shortly. So I assume we'll take a pass on that date, but you will be providing us the new forms so that we can file timely?
Yes, we will.
Yeah, and last year's forms so we can say the same thing we said before?
Yes.
Chairman, clarification on this form business. I'm confused. Does WMATA give us the forms, or do we get the forms from our jurisdictions?
WMATA, Loida will be responsible for getting the forms out to the board members, and she will collect them back.
And then they go?
Don't go anywhere.
They're kept on file. They'll be reviewed by me if there's an issue, if there's an issue that needs to be reviewed, and otherwise they're maintained in the secretary's office, and they're public documents in available.
All right, so Laura, you're in charge of that, so we don't have to worry about the forms. Appreciate it.
In one way that may be a little easier in following the MWA model, currently, if a board member wants to make a change to a disclosure, they revisit their entire disclosure form. The MWA model allows a separate update. Okay, and that's, again, will be part of the new forms. Really, for the rest of the code are things that we've pretty much discussed before. On page 18 of your materials, Article 11, other reports of potential conflicts and suspected ethics violation. Even though that retains a lot of WMATA language, it pretty much tracks MWA already. There are some the highlights in that section relate to process that we're adding to explain how these things happen. The ethics officer, Catherine already spoke to, this again is should be very familiar from prior discussions and from the MWA code. And really from there down, the ethics section on the ethics committee, its operation, interpretation of this code, and other minor provisions. Are all things that we covered in the prior discussions.
Very good.
There is one. I would like to make sure we highlight the provision on sanctions. I don't know exactly where that is, but page 22. Right now, of course, we bring forward and make it clear that under certain circumstances, if a board member conduct rises to the level of conduct that is restricted by the compact provision, section 10, which is a financial, now I don't have it right at my fingertips, but Phil does.
I never stray
far from my compact. There are three sections in the compact, section 10 on the conflict of interest. It does include financial interests. It also includes solicitation in connection with services performed or offering money to obtain an appointment, promotion, or privilege within the authority.
So in this provision of the Code of Ethics, it makes it clear that for violations of those provisions of the compact, at the discretion of the board member may forfeit his or her position with WMATA. In addition to that, there are other sanctions available to the board if a member knowingly violates provisions of this code, and that includes issuing a public reprimand, directing involuntary recusal, removal from positions held on committees, giving notice of the violation to the member's appointing authority, submitting a request to the member's appointing authority that the member be removed, or any other appropriate action regarding the member. Any appropriate action regarding any contract or agreement that is related to the violation can also occur. So a contract could be rescinded if the board member has improperly influenced a contract, for example. Just wanted to highlight those. Those do come out of the MWA code in large part, modified slightly to meet our circumstances, but they are a change to the existing WMATA provisions.
Thank you for mentioning that.
Sorry?
I said thank you for mentioning that. Okay, any questions on anything we've covered thus far, with the one remaining item being the issue of fiduciary duty? Any questions at all on that, those portions? Okay, why don't we go into the fiduciary duty portion?
Okay, so I think it's let me sort of start at the beginning, which we always here at WMATA start with a compact, which is the beginning of all discussions about board member responsibilities. And in Section 4 of the WMATA Compact, the jurisdictions, Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia establish WMATA as a body corporate with corporate governance through a board of directors. And as a matter of law, what that sets up is board member fiduciary duties similar to corporate directors. And that includes things like the duty of loyalty, the duty of care, and duty to avoid conflicts of interest. Depending on what book you're reading about fiduciary duties, sometimes they'll be stated as five duties, and sometimes they'll be collapsed to two or three. We've gone with three. They're sometimes stated separately, a duty of non-disclosure or a duty of confidentiality, and we've dealt with that in concept in our duty of loyalty, but it could be broken out as an additional duty, and I just want to make that clear so you don't become confused. Sometimes when you're reading materials on fiduciary duty, you'll see a duty of confidentiality separately identified. But the concept is brought forward in the Code of Ethics revision that we're suggesting. So I want to focus primarily on the duty of loyalty and the duty of care. The duty to avoid conflicts, I think everybody understands. You want to avoid the appearance of a conflict or an actual conflict, and we've already talked about that in some detail previously in the remarks here today. But the duty of loyalty and the duty of care, I think, merit special consideration, and I think the most important thing to remember about those duties is you have to think of them together. Don't read duty of loyalty and then stop. It's you have to do duty of loyalty and duty of care. They're companion duties, and they function as a unit under the overarching umbrella of fiduciary duty. So if we look at those separately, the duty of loyalty means that a director can only have one master, and the director must act for the principal's benefit in all matters. And in the instance of WMATA's board, WMATA's master is WMATA. Your duty of loyalty to act in good faith and in the best interest, you're pledging that duty to WMATA when you join the WMATA board. You're not to act, to further your own interest, for example, over the interests of WMATA, which is why we have restrictions on, your financial interest in contracts or benefiting from an employment relationship or all of these other duties. That's all about the duty of loyalty. Your duty of loyalty is pledged to WMATA. But you can't stop there because, of course, especially on this board where you have multiple other often public responsibilities and other responsibilities and this isn't your full-time job, you have many stakeholder groups that can and do deserve your allegiance and that you should inform and receive information from them so that you can discharge your duty to WMATA. The duty of care actually requires a board member to reach back and get information from your stakeholder partners, to convey information to your stakeholder partners and to have an open and vigorous dialogue with your stakeholder partners to make sure that your stakeholder partner interests are fully represented at the time when you come forward to WMATA to serve as a WMATA director and discharge your duty to act in the best interest of WMATA. But your duty, it is the duty of care as opposed to the duty of loyalty that establishes the framework and your relationship in going back to your jurisdictional partners or other stakeholder groups to get information, to share information, to participate in the dialogue that that allows you to bring value to them, that allows you to pull value forward and bring to WMATA. But at the end of the day, when it comes time to make a decision, you gather as a group and you all share your interests and the viewpoints of your jurisdictional partners, and you have your vigorous debate, and you come to an agreement, and you vote as a board on behalf of WMATA in a manner that serves the best interest of WMATA. And once the WMATA board has spoken, you then go forward and speak with one voice, even if you lost, you go forward and speak with one voice for the benefit of WMATA, reflecting the decision that the board has made on for the benefit of WMATA. So that's, I imagine there will be lots of questions about that, but in a nutshell, I think it is very, very important to keep in mind that it is really kind of a two-pronged test or duty when you're looking at the relationship piece. You can't stop at the duty of loyalty and without really considering the duty of care. The duty of loyalty and the restriction that's in the code on disclosure of confidential information, I want to emphasize, is a very limited restriction. It is limited to in the code, and in fact is limited to information that is received in executive session, information that is by definition in your bylaws restricted for as being only appropriate to be discussed in an executive session. So those are things like, you know, proprietary trademark information of a vendor, for example, or employment matters that would be inappropriate to have in a public session, or confidential attorney-client communications that might relate to litigation. The list is very specific, and as you know, when we go into a closed session, we speak only to matters that are appropriate in closed session, and matters that are spoken of in closed session need to remain in closed session. The reason you're in closed session is because there are important policy reasons and policy. This is not an unusual provision, of course. There are these provisions in every government or governing body that you serve on, and it is only in that area that this code of ethics has a duty of confidentiality. It's tied very specifically to executive sessions and confidential information shared in executive sessions. So with that, I'll take questions.
That's a very good explanation. I think it's very clear. I think most people would understand that. Any comments, thoughts from members? You have any problem with any of that?
Sort of understand where we are. We are not proposing to create these obligations. They exist by virtue of our structure and our acceptance of membership in the structure, and we're just stating them.
Yeah.
Not stating them wouldn't make them go away.
That's correct. These are duties that operate as a matter of law. You can't ignore them. They exist as a matter of law. You are bound by them as a matter of law.
Yeah. I mean, anybody who sits on another board, obviously, hopefully, has been told about these before, so this shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody that's been anywhere close to a board of directors in their lifetime. Okay, all right, I seem to feel a comfort level here. I should mention, however, that we have received some communication from one of the jurisdictions with respect to that last piece relating to fiduciary responsibility. And so instead of us voting today on this particular issue, we are going to respond back to the jurisdiction so that if there's anyone who has any information that they think we need to hear as a board or as a committee prior to us acting on this next month, we will provide them with that opportunity, and the general counsel and I and possibly the board chair will be willing to meet with the appropriate principal and representative from the Attorney General's office to get any input or suggestions that they may or may not have. But the anticipated schedule is for us to do that fairly quickly, and that in May we will come back to this committee with this document. If there are any suggested changes that come out of those discussions, we will share those with you. Otherwise, we would then anticipate the full board voting to approve this at our May meeting. Mr. Chairman.
Not being a member of the committee, I just want to make a couple of comments. Like you, I have worked for several authorities, and I know from my own experience that this is probably not only the most complex, compact authority, interstate compact authority in the United States. It has two states, the District of Columbia and the Congress, as a party to the creation of the compact. I know that there have been a number of Supreme Court cases that define the legal nature of an interstate compact authority, and that it defines it as creating a new legal entity that in some cases the creating parties have agreed that it will supersede their authority, and the Supreme Court has tried to define that over decades. There are some assumptions here about relationships, about jurisdiction, and I, being appointed by an elected official in the District of Columbia, am acutely aware of those and understand them. I think one of the suggestions in the letter that you and I got was that there be a lawyers committee to look at the legal issues in this piece. And if we are going to participate in that, it should be at the highest level of the attorney generals of the jurisdictions involved, about a conversation that engages the entire region and not just one jurisdiction, about the definitions that we all think are important here, because this is not just about one jurisdiction. This is about the region and the fundamental nature of the compact. And I also know, having served as a director, as you have, on a number of organizations, that there are legal and fiduciary responsibility to the organization that you are a board member of. And as Mort says, just ignoring them doesn't make those responsibilities go away. And I think we need to have a clear understanding of that legal framework as well, about all of our responsibilities. I think there's perhaps a fundamental misunderstanding about the proposed issues around the ethics code revision, but I think they're amenable to a better understanding, and it needs to be done cooperatively with the region. And so I would suggest that an initial, if we're going to tackle this with one jurisdiction, we need to have all three jurisdictions at the table through, hopefully, a senior person at the level of an attorney, the attorney generals of the three jurisdictions, to help frame and better understand the legal issues around the authority. But, and then have that conversation that you've suggested as well.
Mr. Chairman, given that the letter came from the Secretary of Transportation with the state of Maryland, I just want to state for the record, it was always Maryland's intention that it would be a conversation with all of the compact members. This is certainly not a one jurisdiction issue. And while it may be plain to some people, it's not plain to others. And so we think it's important that we have clarity about intention. The state of Maryland is committed to having all of our board members fulfill all of our responsibilities, but we do want clarity about that relationship. It's certainly not an unreasonable request, given that there's lots of litigation around this issue of fiduciary responsibility. There are lots of cases to give us guidance on it. Not specifically on this, but it is an issue of governance. I've been involved in two lawsuits on this very issue. So, reasonable people disagree.
Thank you.
No, I totally appreciate that, and I will get with the general counsel, and we will put together one session where we, and it's not going to be a committee. Just saying lawyers committee sends chills up my spine. Not going to do it. So we will work to put that together.
I would also ask, if you're taking that look, at least consider, and I maybe ask general counsel to think about this, should we invite any federal input into that discussion? And where we would get it, I'm not sure. But I think it is, and it certainly is an issue for me.
Yeah,
and it may be an issue for some of the federal agencies.
Okay, well, with that discussion, I think the charge for the general counsel and myself is clear. We will undertake to do this fairly quickly. And when we have our next governance committee, which is, I guess, May 7th, is that right, Lloyd, whenever our next meeting day is, we will hopefully be in a position to take final action on this with as a result of any input we get. But I appreciate all the comments. Anything else, Madam General Counsel or General Manager? You have anything you want to say on this?
I do think we had an information item that we wanted to to bring
bylaws.
Forward on the bylaws.
Yes, which is consistent with what we just discussed.
I received a request from Mr. Downey, who had, in his spare time, been reading the bylaws of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. Another compact agency.
That I have no further connection with.
The Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, like WMATA, is an interstate compact agency. And in that compact authority, they, too, have clear statements of fiduciary duty and responsibilities back to the authority. And Mr. Downey requested that we bring forward into our bylaws a statement of fiduciary duty similar to that which was found by him in the Port Authority's bylaws. And so with his direction and at his request, we did bring forward a suggestion of where we might include a similar provision in our bylaws. It would be found on our bylaws. I don't have the
page 36 in
Article 2B, and it would just be a simple statement what we're suggesting. This is the statement that talks about and we already have in our bylaws five statements of fiduciary responsibility. But this adds a more clear statement that says exercise of fiduciary duty to WMATA as more fully described in the Code of Ethics for members of the WMATA Board of Directors, including a duty of loyalty to act in the best interest of WMATA, a duty of care to make reasonable efforts to be diligent, attentive, and prudent when considering matters before the board, and a duty to avoid conflicts of interest, including the appearance of a conflict. So that has been suggested, and we brought that forward as a proposed revision to the bylaws. It would just be the appropriate counterpart in the bylaw document.
Very good.
And again, as I asked earlier, this isn't creating those obligations. It's really just forcefully bringing them to the attention of board members and the public.
Yeah. As I said, it's a basic fundamental principle of corporate law that you have a fiduciary responsibility as a board member to the board on which you sit. But sometimes it's not quite as clear.
We'll make the comment, having this in the Port Authority bylaws didn't prevent them from
taking it.
In the least.
It didn't help them.
All you can do is provide guidance, I can assure you. That's it. Okay, well, we will take that up at the same time as we take up these other changes to the Code of Ethics and hopefully act on both at the same time. Is there anything else that anyone has for the good of the cause at this point? Hearing none. Thank you, Madam General Counsel, and Mr. Staub, it was a very good presentation, very clear. I think everybody understands where we need to go, so we really appreciate it. And we are adjourned.
Yes, I